This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Lynn Stewart will be with us once again. Lynn is the attorney who the government went after for her vigorous defense of Sheikh Abdelrahman.
She's been sentenced on October 16th. The government has said in its sentencing memorandum that they want to make an example out of her, and they're recommending to the judge that Lynn be put away for 30 years.
The last month has been devoted to highlighting the case of the Cuban Five. Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a listen to a few segments from some of those events.
The Cuban Five have been in five of the worst prisons in America for the last 8 years. Even as Luis Posada Carriles, an admitted terrorist who participated in the murder of 73 people when he helped blow up an Sicilian airplane, is being released by the U.S. government.
We'll also talk with author Jack Rasmus, whose new book, The War at Home, talks about the imbalance of wealth and resources in this country.
It's subtitled Economic Class War in America, the assault against our economic situation, our democratic rights, and the cultural wars they're waging on us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we want to update our listeners to Law and Disorder, of an incredible thing that's happened in this last week. While we were moving toward a police state over the last few years, on Saturday, the president signed into law a piece of legislation called the Military Commission Act. I call it the Police State Act, because this piece of legislation really wipes out fundamental rights that we have been used to in this country for 200 and some years, and that we've been used to really in the world almost since 1215, when the Magna Carta gave people the writ of habeas corpus, the right to test their detention, to go to court and demand of the government, why are you holding me? Last week, I spent my entire week in a place I don't usually like to go. I spent it in Washington, D.C., trying to make enough of our senators vote against the stripping of habeas corpus from our law, taking it away, abolishing it, getting rid of it for the people in Guantanamo. Unfortunately, despite a week of work, a group of us lawyers who represent the Guantanamo detainees, particularly those from the Center for Constitutional Rights, despite our work, we lost the vote in the end in really one of the more sad scenes that I've seen. I watched the vote on C-SPAN. It was 48 in our favor and 51 against. That means 51 of our nation's senators voted to get rid of, strip, abolish, whatever word you want to use, suspend the writ of habeas corpus for people at Guantanamo and really for every alien anywhere in the world. In other words, once an alien, a non-citizen, even a legal permanent resident is taken into custody, whether in the United States, in Bagram, in Iraq, wherever they are, wherever that alien is, the United States can hold that person forever, indefinitely, and never let them go into a court. They've suspended the writ. They've abolished the writ. It's gone. Pretty serious stuff. So that's what I spent my week on. I was incredibly upset. The president signed this bill on a Saturday. What does it mean? Certainly, in the writ of habeas corpus, what it means, first of all, is for the 460 people, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and other people represent at Guantanamo. We have 460 habeas corpus cases pending in the federal courts right now. All of those cases, if this act is upheld, will be eliminated, essentially, from the federal court. And our 460 men at Guantanamo, many of whom have been there for 5 years, will continue indefinite detention, perhaps forever. Certainly, even if we hold this act unconstitutional or this stripping of habeas unconstitutional, it's going to take us another year or two to get it held unconstitutional. So we're talking about people who have been now, will have been in Guantanamo already 5 years, will have been there for 7 years before they even get a court hearing. Now I say before they even get a court hearing, but it makes me think about that. Because, you know, twice we have gone to the Supreme Court and twice we have won the right for our Guantanamo detainees to file in court and have a hearing as to whether or not they can be detained. In other words, twice we've gotten the Supreme Court to say, you have a writ of habeas corpus. The first time was in 2004. The administration of George Bush said, you can't have the right. The Supreme Court said, you do. Then George Bush went to Congress, and Congress rolled over and tried to strip the habeas right in 2005 from our clients. It goes to the Supreme Court again. The Supreme Court says, oh, no, you don't. They have the right of habeas corpus. And what happens again on Saturday? President signs into law the legislation again, called the Military Commission Act, as I said, called the Police State Act, stripping the right of habeas again from any alien in the United States or anywhere in the world who is held in detention by the United States. So think about it. Tomorrow, your neighbor, a legal permanent resident, picked up by the United States, picked up by the administration, labeled an enemy combatant, put into some brig somewhere, and that's it. Never heard from again. No court can look at what is happening to that person. No court can test whether or not it was a legal detention. Same would apply, alien picked up in Germany, alien picked up in the Philippines, taken to some CIA secret detention facility, taken to Guantanamo. If we ever get their name, you would think we might be able to go to court and try and get that person a hearing as to whether they were properly detained. But no, no right to go into court, habeas corpus stripped completely. Think about for a second the client that I'm sure many of you are familiar with that we have at the center, Maher Arar. He's the Canadian citizen, ripped off a plane at Kennedy Airport, taken by the United States to Syria, put into Syrian custody, and tortured in Syria. Let's say we had found out early on, and we could file a writ of habeas corpus, because really his custody while in Syria was really at the behest of the United States. No more. Maher Arar would remain in Syria. The court couldn't do anything. Think about it. Right now, as we speak, there may be hundreds. In fact, there are 14,000 U.S. detainees around the world between Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places, Guantanamo. None of those people, unless they're citizens of the United States, and I don't know that any of them are, none of them have the writ of habeas corpus left. Fundamental right, it really is, to me, the definition of a police state. A police state is one in which the authority, the king, the president, whatever you want to call him, can basically take you by the scruff of the neck, toss you into some dungeon, and you're never heard from again, and no court can come between you and the power or the authoritarian power of the king or the president. That's what we got here if you're an alien that's labeled by this administration as an enemy combatant. And just remember, it includes legal permanent residents in the United States, undocumented workers in the United States, and any alien abroad. Now, I know that there's a fight back. It's not hopeless. We're in court already at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We have cases throughout the system that are going to test this almost immediately as to whether it's constitutional or legal. But again, we're going to be litigating it for a year. Now, when I say I wish I could end, I can't end now because there's other aspects of the Military Commission Act, as I said, the PSA or Police State Act, that I have to talk about before I finish this short explanation of what a bad week we've had for our liberty and for really human rights in the world. Three other aspects I want to mention of the Military Commission Act. The first is it contains a definition of enemy combatant. Enemy combatant is a term the Bush administration has used as a way of sort of labeling people, or not sort of, but labeling people so that they're beyond the law. They call the people at Guantanamo unlawful enemy combatants. And that, of course, initially meant for them Geneva Conventions don't apply, no law applies, we can do whatever we want, we can actually torture these people, etc. In some way, the Military Commission Act is misnamed. 90 pages deal with military commissions, that's true. But what's happening in the Act is much more serious than just what they're doing with military commissions. Only 5 pages of the Act concern the 3 issues we've discussed, which is the removal of habeas corpus jurisdiction, the broadened definition of enemy combatant to include U.S. citizens, and the permission allowance of torture going forward. That's really, in my view, the core of the violations that this Act undertakes. The Military Commissions Act, it allows people to be tried by these special rump, kangaroo court military commissions. But to be very fair, very few people are going to be tried by that. Only 10 people out of the 460 at Guantanamo have even been charged. The new 14 that the president brought over from secret CIA detention facilities are supposedly going to be tried as well. So it's not really a large universe. The large universe are those Guantanamo detainees and others who've been stripped of habeas and on which torture may well continue. That's not to say that the Military Commission Act should not be looked at. I don't like military commissions. I think that people have to be tried in regular courts. As soon as you set up military commissions, you're setting up a special ad hoc court. That means you're bending the rules in favor of conviction. Despite the Supreme Court ruling, that's what this Military Commission Act does with military commissions. It bends the rules in favor of prosecution. It allows broad hearsay evidence, in other words, evidence you can't cross-examine. It still allows secret evidence so that the detainee cannot see all the evidence against him. And most amazingly, it still allows evidence of torture. It still allows evidence that comes from torture or coercion. Not a fair process at all. So we've had some week here. We've had a week in which the gloves are off, in which the so-called everybody says, well, the president is doing this without going to Congress. You have to go to Congress because this is a part of the checks and balances. It's just a bunch of BS. He not only went to Congress, he got more out of Congress than he was willing to try and do before. Congress actually made it worse. So let's remember, as we're in this struggle here, we at the center are on the front lines of this. We're in court constantly on this. I just spoke to one of our lawyers in Guantanamo. She's there right now trying to do her best. We'll be filing a number of new cases to challenge this act over the next period. But of course, court litigation isn't the only thing that's going to win us here. We need real protest to what's going on. We need an activist country. We need a country that says, we will not be deprived of rights that go back to the Magna Carta. We will not have people treated as if they are animals, as if they're cattle, as if they're of no account. It's an outrage what's going on here, and we have to all finally, if we haven't done it yet, stand up for our fundamental rights.
We're real glad to have Lynn Stewart back in the studio with us again. The cold truth is, 14 days from now, on October 16th, she's going to be sentenced. The government wants to put her away for 30 years. Again, as many listeners know, this is a landmark case, an obvious attempt by the U.S. government to silence dissent, curtail vigorous defense lawyers, and instill fear in those who would stand up against the U.S. government's racism and seek to help Arabs and Muslims being prosecuted for free speech. Lynn's case was in court last week, challenging the government, who maintain that they've got a right to spy on attorneys and their clients without even getting warrants. The government won't even admit that they did this. And if they did, they would, under the law, be forced to drop the charges against Lynn. So that hearing, the NSA hearing, was last week, and we're going to be able to talk to Lynn about that. Lynn Stewart, welcome again to Law and Disorder. Heidi Boghossian and I were 3 weeks ago at the oral argument when Michael Avery, the president of the Lawyers Guild, representing the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Shane Cotadell from the center, argued the same sort of motion that you were in court on last week. And that is, the NSA, the National Security Agency, said that they can spy on people, including lawyers, without even getting a warrant. People at the center suspected, and I think rightly, that the government was spying on them and spying on their conversations with their clients. And I suspect they were doing the same with you, and I know that's why you were in court. Lynn, what do you think?
it's a slightly different posture because it's a criminal case. In other words, the issues of standing, which is a big issue in the CCR and the Civil Liberties Union, whether they have standing to even come in and say, I think it's happening. But here we're demanding on behalf of a criminal defendant to know whether or not they did illegal things in the course of a prosecution, which, of course, as we all know, has me facing 30 years. So it puts it in a different context. And I think for that reason, it's a little more pointed, let's say, than perhaps a civil litigation would be.
Now, how did it go in court? Michael and I unfortunately weren't there.
We had nice turnout. We filled the courtroom. There were a lot of people very interested in this, and my lawyer, Josh Dreitel, he did the oral argument, and he was very, very brilliant, I thought. He told the judge, there's only three answers the government could have given you to the question of were there NSA wiretaps of Lynn Stewart. They could have said yes, or they could have said, we have no idea because we've so encrypted these wiretaps and disseminated them to our law enforcement people that we don't even know who we wiretapped anymore. Or they could say no. But any one of the answers, no maybe, would mean no, we don't want to tell you, or no, we didn't do it. Any one of those answers we'd be entitled to get as defendant to be able to carry it further. The judge's questions basically went to who was cleared. Now, you know, that's the latest thing. Lawyers now have to be cleared to be able to handle, quote, sensitive material. It originally was called a SIPA clearance, Confidential Information Something Something Act. My lawyer, Josh Dreitel, who is a Guantanamo lawyer, he said, well, I'm cleared for just about everything, he said.
Are you saying that the government lawyers also have to be cleared?
Yes, apparently they do as well. I'm not sure how that works. They had a special man. Their man from Washington, Mr. Bruce, came to argue the case. Apparently this is his career. He goes from court to court all over the country arguing these cases.
And, surveillance cases.
Surveillance, yeah. And I think NSA. Right. And I thought the judge became slightly miffed with him, actually, when he sort of included the judge in a sweeping remark that, well, we all know such and such. And the judge says, if you're judging that from my questions, I warn you, don't judge anything from the questions I ask.
Who is the judge, Lynn, in this
case? It is the same judge that we have had. It's the judge in charge of the criminal prosecution, Codal, John Codal.
Why do you say that you've got a right to learn whether the government was spying on your conversations with your client?
Well, Michael, you and I go back long enough to remember those old cases with Richard Nixon where he said to the Weather Underground, we can spy on you because it's a national security. And no, we don't have to get a warrant. No, we don't have to do anything. And the Supreme Court really slapped them back in a number of cases, some of which are still good law. The Alderson, which was a case which spelled out what steps had to be taken, et cetera. The judge asked the government prosecutor, well, do you think Alderson still applies? And he said, I don't think I'm familiar with Alderson, which really made all of us blink. It's a lawyer, as we all know. That's a wonderful moment when your adversary doesn't know the case the judge is talking about. But at any rate, this is still good law. And in a criminal context, of course, if they have pursued an illegality, it can taint the entire case. That's the old rubric, you know, if there's a bad search and you get an address from it, you go to that address and you find 10 tons of drugs, everything gets suppressed because it begins with an illegality on the part of the prosecutor, the government.
Lynn, if something really good happens here, is it possible that A, the government is caught doing something illegal, and B, that would lead to their having to dismiss the case against you?
Well, as you know, the defense bar, and I guess defendants too, we live in optimism and in hope that there's going to be something that will turn the case, especially a case like this, which we have such, it's not myself only I speak for, but the whole criminal bar and activists all over this country that have such a sense that this case smells, it stinks. Anything that could happen would be good. And we also have a sense, at least I have this sense, they pulled all the stops out. A government that wants to send me to jail for 30 years because I'm now a terrorist you know, they didn't stop at anything. And they seem to like lawyers. They like listening to lawyers. So we think it has some legs. Whether it will get anywhere, I can't tell you.
I know they pulled all the stops because they now have admitted in their sentencing memorandum when they recommended the 30 years to a 67-year-old woman, they said in their memorandum, we want to make an example out of her. And that's what we were saying all along. And now they've come out and admitted that because the horror of it was that they didn't go after you committed your crime of letting out a press release. They went after you almost 2 years later. They went after you not under the Democratic administration. This is not to say the Democrats are great on civil liberties, but the administration changed. 9/11 happened. Bush was, I shouldn't say elected, he assumed the presidency. And it was only after that that they went after you. So they deliberately went after you quite cold-bloodedly. I remember when Ashcroft, for our younger listeners, he was the attorney general at one time, and he came and announced your indictment on the David Letterman show. I mean, how do you get a fair trial after the guy
and
goes on national TV?
He sang a song after that, too.
Yes, he
sang.
Did he sing the song?
Yes, he sang a song about the eagle and we have no king but God, which was a surprise to me because I thought we had no king at all in this country. And I didn't think, I thought God was a matter of personal choice. But
well, that's what the founding fathers thought. And we've on our show discussed the fact that most of them weren't even Christians. Lynn, if the judge is going to come down on the right side, what sort of things do you think would influence him?
Well, I think that he is still reading over whatever the government has submitted to him. And I think that if he opens it up to the adversarial process, which is what is supposed to happen in all trials, or not trials, but in all cases involving criminal matters, he may indeed find some new room for thought. It also is, of course, law that the president's NSA spying is unconstitutional and has been held by other district courts to be so. That, and also, I have to say that along with being a lawyer, I've always had politics, and those politics sort of tell me that times have moved and changed. And the judge that got this case 6 months after 9/11 is like the rest of us, a little bit different now, a little bit less believing.
I think so, too. I think possibly a turning point, because the judge, like the rest of us, reads the New York Times every day. And you read the editorial page of the Times, and you see how they were opposed to these military commissions. That the executive is now saying, the hell with the judiciary, we can set up our own courts, and you got nothing to say about it. We're going to indict people, we're going to try them, we're going to sentence them, we're going to use evidence based on hearsay, based on torture. We're ruling out habeas corpus, so we're going to keep people forever. And we can do all of this, and the judiciary has nothing to say about it. And I think that kind of overarching, arrogant power grab by the executive has got the judiciary worried. And I think the judge, however liberal or illiberal he may be, I don't know. But I think that's the kind of thing, just in the interest of separation of powers, is offending people like the judge.
I agree with you, Michael. And even apropos of that, in the New York Times, this was a case of someone, a businessman who had a website who was quite interestingly conscripted into being an illegal informant by means of a subpoena from the FBI, which he wasn't allowed to talk about. And when he brought a lawsuit and it was decided in his favor, then they passed new laws making it impossible for any citizen who is in a similar position, that is, give us information about this customer of yours, even if it means you have to lie, even if it means you must dissemble, it makes it impossible for anybody to even bring a lawsuit now, because if the FBI certifies national security, the judge's hands are tied, the whole judicial system is supposed to stand up and salute, if you'll excuse the expression.
Yeah, that's precisely what's unfolding. It came beginning with the Patriot Act, you know, with the librarians. You know better than anybody, having been a librarian, that the FBI can come, find out what kind of books somebody's taken out of the library or what kind of internet sites they're hitting, can find that information out, and then they send the librarian to prison if the librarian blows the whistle.
Right, exactly. It's even, to me, it's so insidious, the notion of citizen informants. Yeah. It really, you really have the sense
it's a fascist notion.
Of the fascist
yeah. Sure.
The government enlisting people and making them so afraid that they kowtow.
Lynn, in a few weeks, your sentencing will occur. I know there have been a lot of wonderful events going on in the weeks leading up to this. I saw a fabulous film that was made about you at St. Mark's Church. How are you feeling?
Well, I can't say I'm not stressed, because of course I am. And of course that means that my wonderful partner, Ralph, is getting the brunt of it, grumpy, irritable stuff. But we're trying to keep our heads up, as the guys in the upstate jail say. You know, I'm still keeping my head up. We have a series of wonderful events, a lot of appearances on WBAI, as well as public speaking and attending other people's events. We're just going to build up to this. And as last night at the Lower East Side event, as Father Frank Morales said, a pastor at St. Mark's, he said, "We just want to have so many people turn out for this sentencing. Just everybody that hears this should bring 10 people with them. And if we just by our numbers alone show the sense of outrage we have that somehow or other the government really thinks it, first of all, it can take away a lawyer that spent 30 years in service to a community that never had lawyers in service to it, but more importantly to the movement, that it would take away the independence of lawyers that do political cases, because this is really what this is about. I don't care whether you like the Sheikh's politics or you don't like the Sheikh's politics. It was a political case. He was not motivated by money or greed. And the fact of the matter is, it's saying this person can't speak, and you, the lawyer, have to make sure that happens, even if it goes against your judgment, your independent judgment about what would be best for his case.
Well, exactly. You know, there's that old saw that we learn in law school, that bad cases make bad law. If they can get you because you exercised your First Amendment right, as well as the client's Sixth Amendment right under counsel, to give voice to what your client was telling you. Next time, let's say they'll get Heidi Boghossian because she's a supporter of the Cuban Five, or an anti-war activist who happens to be in jail for one thing or another. And the lawyer will come out of the jail cell after visiting her and say, "Well, Heidi says, organize another demonstration next Thursday." And they're going to slap you in jail for saying that. Bad cases make bad law. And you may not like the politics of the Sheikh, but that's not what it's about. It's a different principle.
It is a very different principle. And as I say, this ability of this government to fold over. In other words, part of the basis of my conviction, part of the argument of the government to the jury was, she's got radical politics. She therefore would further the Sheikh's goals. We know, because we know politics, nothing could be further from the truth. My politics, my goals are completely different from his. But by folding that over, and what is the fold? The fold is anyone who's opposed to us. Anyone who's against us, whether they're whoever they come from, we're going to put them in bed together and send them to jail together.
At the sentencing, the courtroom is going to be packed. We know that. Will they let people stand in the halls and outside?
Well, what we're hoping for is that the courtroom will be packed. Okay. And the overflow room will, with a television set, will also be filled. We're not actually asking the judge to put us in one of those huge courtrooms, because they really overwhelm the personhood in there. You feel the lawyers, we talked about this yesterday, that you feel like so diminished, you're so minuscule in there. We hope he'll do it in his own courtroom, and we'll fill up that courtroom. We'll fill up an overflow, and we'll fill up the hall, and we'll fill up outside, and we'll fill up Foley Square, and we'll fill up Center Street, and we'll fill up Lafayette Street, and it will just be this mass of people, all of whom will wait and be witness to whatever this judge decides to do. And if he does not give a custodial sentence, that is, if he says probation, if he says community service and house arrest, if he says any of those things, then we will know that the power of the people is still alive and well and that it works. What? And if he doesn't say it, I'm not sure. I assume people will feel that they have to go right on fighting. I know that's what I will feel like.
Yeah, you can be assured that we will, Lynn. What time, what place, where can we come?
Okay, well, I think that I first want to say that we're on the 15th. That's the day before.
October 15th.
We will be at Riverside Church. We have the largest hall they have. We hope to fill it. We have a lot of people promising. We hope they'll show up. We're going to have a day of or an afternoon starting at 4 o'clock of rally, of let's get out there and do it. Go get your friends. Go get your grandchildren. Come and see the sentencing because it really is that important. And then the next day at 8 o'clock, we're going to start the rally in Foley Square.
That's 8 o'clock in the morning, October 16th.
October 16th. And Foley Square is located between Center and Lafayette. Yet on Worth Street. It's also called Tom Paine Park, which, of course, we all have to love. And we'll start there. We'll have a rally there. And then at 10 o'clock, the sentencing begins. We've asked people to be there by at least 9:30. And then I will be escorted to the courthouse. Of course, my escort will be my family and then my enlarged family, my family of politics and movement and activism of all these many years.
And what a big family that is, Lynn.
I hope so. I've been saying, you know, you have to die to find out how many people love you. I've been finding it out, and it's overwhelming and very humbling in a way to be thought of so highly by so many different people.
Well, I'm sure that I'm articulating the thoughts of all our listeners when we say, Lynn Stewart, stay healthy, be free, and we'll be out there with you on the 15th of October at Riverside Church, 4 o'clock, and the next day, 8 o'clock in the morning, Foley Square, October 16th, sentencing's at 10 o'clock. Thank you, Lynn Stewart.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've talked at length about the legislation and policy the U.S. government is installing to create what amounts to be a police state in this country. Today we talk with Jack Rasmus, journalist and author of The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. This book examines the relationship between the emerging police state and the great shift in wealth, salaries, earnings, diminution of health care, pensions, destruction of unions, and all the rest that started under Reagan. We'll also talk with Jack Rasmus about class struggle and the relationship between democratic rights and the ability to make social change. Jack is an economics and labor journalist for Z Magazine and The Dispatcher.
Jack Rasmus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I'm holding your new book, The War at Home, in my hand. What strikes me as being so wise about this book, and I'm halfway through it now, is the subtitle, Economic Class War in America. The listeners to Law and Disorder have regularly heard us speak about the constitutional crisis that we're in. It started before Bush, but certainly accelerated after 9/11. What I thought was so intelligent about your book, you're weaving together the economic war, the crushing ongoing in scope of the civil liberties, democratic rights war, and then also the cultural war. Can you lay out for our listeners the various aspects of the economic class war in America?
Sure. First comment I would have is that something very unique is happening in the U.S. today, and that is a threefold convergence and crisis, the first part of which is economic and structural, and that's primarily what the book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, addresses. But there are two other major dimensions, as you've pointed out, and they are related to the economic crisis here. And those other two dimensions are the attack on the democracy and civil liberties, and as well the deepening crisis here between values and the cultural conflicts in this country. And you really have to go back to the decade leading up to the Civil War, way back to 1850, to see such a similar convergence of a threefold crisis, economic, political, democratic, and cultural. All the other crises that have occurred in the last century, the 20th century, have been one or maybe two, but never all three. So this is really something unique that's going on. My book really looks at the economic, primarily the economic aspect of this, and points out that in the late 1970s, corporate America really got together and launched a new offensive on all these fronts, particularly the economic front. The implementation of this new corporate offensive really began under Reagan, but it's continued ever since, growing in momentum right through the Clinton years, and of course we see its acceleration. And the hallmark I try to point out in the book is that the consequence of this massive economic restructuring has been a record transfer of income from the 105 million working middle class folks who earn their living primarily with a paycheck to the wealthiest 10% households. One thing I try to do in the book is to document and quantify this massive transfer of income, which now is approaching $1 trillion every year.
Yeah, I understand from reading the Times that there are now 401 billionaires in the United States. Being a millionaire is really an insignificant accomplishment nowadays.
Oh, well, there's over 7 million millionaires in the United States right now. It's largely because of this huge transfer of income over the last 25 years. And the book talks about the various ways this transfer has been brought about. Primarily, the transfer of high-paying jobs offshore. We've lost 12 million quality jobs. We are running an $800 billion trade deficit, and the Commerce Department has estimated for every $1 billion of trade deficit, we lose 13,000 jobs. Executive pay has gone through the roof. Corporate profits are at a four-year record level. They've gone up 10-15% every quarter for the last 4 years, higher than any record they've ever kept. In 1980, a typical CEO made 35 times the average pay of a worker in his company. Today, they're making over 500 times the average pay of a worker in the company. If you look at the average real wage after inflation for the 105 million workers in this country, it amounts to a 1.2 cent per hour per year average wage increase for those folks. Workers and middle-class people have kept up their standard of living, not through wage increases, but by working many longer hours. American workers work more hours than anybody in the world by credit and by living off the assets in their homes if they happen to own a home and through refinancing. So, you know, the working class is not increasing its standard of living. They're spinning their wheels at best. Many of them at the median pay and below are going backwards, and they're doing it not through wage increases, but they're doing it through other means as well, which, of course, have a limited potential in the long run. You can only work so many hours, and you can only refinance your house so many times in order to maintain your standard of living.
How does this really crushing of the standard of living and the expectations for the majority of Americans, how does that fit in with what our listening audiences come to know as the constitutional crisis that's really accelerated since 9/11 in this country?
Well, this couldn't have been pulled off. The book looks at two approaches to this transfer of income. One, at the corporate company level. What are the policies and strategies and tactics that corporations have introduced to affect this massive transfer of income? And it also looks at it from the top down. In other words, what are the legislative political changes that have facilitated this massive transfer of income? Because the two work together. One could not have done it alone without the other. For example, the huge amount of jobs that have been offshored in this country would not have been possible without the free trade policies and would not have been possible without the tax changes which have enabled that massive transfer and provided incentives of jobs offshore. Now, in turn, this could not have happened without major political changes, which also began to occur in the 1980s. There's a massive economic restructuring going on, but there's a corresponding political restructuring going on at the same time that isn't perhaps as obvious. And the book talks about that, how the Republican Party became a mobilizing party as a result of corporate strategies in the late 70s and early 80s, and how also the Democratic Party fundamentally changed. It's no longer the party of Roosevelt as we once knew it. After 8 years of defeats facing Reagan, what happened in the Democratic Party is there was a right corporate turn in the late 1980s, represented by the takeover of the party pretty much by the Democratic Leadership Conference, the DLC as it's called, which has pretty much run the party and driven the progressive elements into a corner more and more.
I'm interested in one issue, that of Social Security, and you talk briefly about how we might restore true equity. Mm-hmm. What would that look like?
Well, people should understand that part of this massive transfer is what's happened with Social Security. If you look back in the mid-1980s, major, quote, reform of Social Security occurred where they started raising the cost of it, the payroll deduction for Social Security, and that generated this $4 trillion surplus over the years. Now, as I argue in a book in the last chapter, this $4 trillion surplus has been totally moved from the Social Security Trust Fund to the U.S. General Budget Fund to the amount of $400 billion a year now, and it's been pretty much spent to provide the tax cuts for the wealthy and to fund the war spending here over the last 10 years, and increase in the defense budget. People say, well, you know, that money can always be put back. It's owed by the government to itself. Yes, in an accounting sense, the government could go to the investment banks in New York and borrow the $4 trillion, put it back in the trust fund, because there's only IOUs there now. But if they did that, they would then have to add to their general budget deficits another $300-400 billion every year. So they're never going to do that. They have spent that money, which is workers' payroll deduction money, the surplus that Social Security has generated, $4 trillion of principal and interest in the last 25 years. Now, the way to resolve this question is the payroll tax for Social Security tops out at $90,000. So it's only hitting people who work for a living, people who earn a paycheck, a salary. You could solve this problem, put all that money back, and provide free drug benefits for everybody, and solve the Medicare deficit problem if you put 10% tax on all incomes, not just on salary, but on all capital incomes as well. In other words, everybody pays the 10%, and you would be able to generate enough income from a 10% tax on all incomes, capital income, capital gains, taxes, dividends, interest, and so forth, to solve the whole so-called Social Security crisis, replace that money, and expand benefits as well. If you look at just the tax shelters, in 1982, $250 billion was held in offshore tax shelters by corporations and the rich. Today, $7 trillion, and probably more, that's what it's admitted, is in offshore tax shelters alone. They've been just squirreling this money away offshore rather than paying taxes.
Let's say that the kind of information that you're helping people understand gets out there. And let's say that the class consciousness of the people who are being screwed over now really rises to a high level, and that the kind of community and labor organizations and alliances that we're all hoping for get going. We know that the Army is training the local police. We remember during the Republican convention here in New York when they preemptively arrested a couple thousand people who were doing nothing except protesting Bush, and they held them for over a day so they couldn't come back out and protest. What concerns us is that as the economic situation gets worse and worse and people want to try to rise up and do something about it, these laws that have criminalized dissent and that have brought the Army in against really the Posse Comitatus Act says you can't do it, but you got the Army doing local law enforcement. And what concerns us is the conjuncture between the emerging police state and economic crisis that you have been describing to us.
As you point out, you know, now we have, for the first time in history, what's called a Northern Command. That's for the United States, North America. As you pointed out, New York, but also the Army was very much in the wings in the demonstrations in Miami.
In Seattle.
And, also in Seattle. So they anticipate the use of these forces if necessary. This new social movement formation must raise demands for protecting and expanding democracy as redistributing back the income that's been stolen.
Yeah, absolutely. They go hand in hand. Democracy doesn't exist in the abstract. It's really a tool for social struggle. Jack, we've really been pleased and privileged to have you on Law and Disorder.
And we just like to tell people The War at Home, it's in bookstores now.
You can order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, so forth. And you can also order it from my personal website, which is kyklosproductions.com.
Spell Kyklos, please.
K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com.
The War at Home, it's an important, intelligent, wise book. Jack Rasmus, thanks very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Over the past few weeks, events have been held around the country to raise awareness of the plight of the Cuban Five, five courageous men who uncovered information about plans by anti-Cuban terrorists to commit acts of violence against that island nation. After the Cuban government turned over voluminous documentation of such plans, the five were indicted and tried in Miami on unfounded charges of conspiracy to commit espionage, all without one page of evidence to corroborate such charges. The five have been imprisoned for 8 years in maximum security facilities around the country, unable to see their families, and in such remote locations that even visits from their attorneys are difficult. And of course, media coverage of their case has been nearly non-existent. Hopefully this will change, especially in light of recent revelations that the Bush administration has poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into paying Miami journalists to plant misleading and erroneous stories related to Cuba issues. In D.C., a large rally in March to the White House attracted 600 marchers and was followed by a panel of speakers, including Len Wineglass and Francisco Letelier, the son of Orlando Letelier, who, along with his assistant Ronnie Moffitt, was assassinated on the streets of Washington, D.C. in a brutal car bombing 3 decades ago, in the first act of international terrorism on U.S. soil. Also speaking at the panel was Livio DeSelmo, whose brother Fabio was killed in a 1997 hotel bombing in Havana.
Our own Heidi Boghossian was also a speaker on that panel and at an earlier event in New York. She spoke welcoming Esteban Lazo Hernandez, the vice president of the Cuban Council of State. Let's take a listen to part of the New York talk.
Attorney Heidi Boghossian is here with us to give an update about the case of the Cuban Five. Heidi Boghossian is executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, which has been fighting against injustice in this country since 1937. And she is a co-host of Law and Disorder, a WBAI radio program that I'm sure many of you listen to. Let me introduce Heidi Boghossian.
Good evening. For those of you familiar with the case of the Cuban Five, forgive me for repeating what many of you already know, but I thought it would be important just to review the facts of the case and how the Cuban Five got to be where they are today. The case of the Cuban Five is a travesty of justice that has received too little public opinion and attention in this country. It presents a classic example of how the legal system typically responds to voices of the powerful rather than to the call of justice. The five came to the United States to monitor organizations working against the government of Cuba and to gather information about violent activity directed against their country. They were successful. In 1998, their government provided U.S. authorities with volumes of information that the five had compiled on terrorist activities planned against their island. The material included addresses, locations of camps, and activities by the groups in question that were violating U.S. laws because they planned to carry out military action against a nation with which the United States was not at war. But instead of acting on that information to halt the violent activities of extremists, the FBI used it to track down and arrest the five Cuban men who admitted they were working for the Cuban government. As you know, the five were indicted in 1998 on charges that they admitted to, such as failing to register as agents of a foreign government, as well as more serious charges that they were not guilty of, such as engaging in conspiracy to commit murder. You'll remember that their trial was the longest that has ever taken place in U.S. history, lasting nearly 6 months with over 100 volumes of transcripts and over 200 depositions from multiple witnesses. Yet where did we hear about this in the U.S. mainstream media? The trial was riddled with violations. Among the most chilling was the use of classified evidence to convict the five, evidence that was off limits to defense attorneys under the Classified Information Act. One of their lawyers, you all know, veteran civil rights attorney Len Weinglass, noted that this is the first case in the history of the United States in which a court has said, "Ladies and gentlemen, although this is a case of espionage, we don't have any specific document, not a single page that accuses the five of acts of espionage." When it was all over, as you know, the five were found guilty of 26 charges and were sentenced to life in prison or very harsh prison terms. The defense presented its appeal to the 11th Circuit panel, which took 16 months to reach a verdict. And a year ago in July, in a record-breaking 93-page ruling, the longest in the history of the U.S., the court ruled that they had not gotten a fair trial and they reversed the sentences. As you know, this was a stunning victory for the five. In an opinion that included extensive review of United States terrorist attacks against Cuba, which the five came to deter and instead were prosecuted, the judges found that community atmosphere, the coercion and threats made against jurors during trial, negative publicity, attitude of the jurors, actions of the prosecutor, and the motions made before and during and after trial all infected their trial with unfairness. The judges even looked at juror responses during the voir dire process of jurors who weren't selected, but whose answers illuminated the depth of prejudice in the Miami community at large. Those jurors talked about how they would be afraid to return a verdict of not guilty, and how they had preconceived notions about anyone who would be associated with the government of Cuba. After this remarkable decision, however, Attorney General Gonzalez asked that the entire 11th Circuit Court of Appeals review the panel's decision. That this request was even made revealed how political this case was. And because this was a highly political case from the outset, it was not a surprise to many of us that this past July, the 11th Circuit reinstated the five's convictions and harsh sentences. The court ignored the fact that a host of community, media, and prosecutorial factors worked together to create what they called, the earlier court had called, the perfect storm of unfairness and prejudice that made a just decision impossible. And the five continue to be held, as you know, in extremely harsh conditions, scattered around the country in different and remote maximum security facilities, rarely allowed to visit with family and making visits from their attorneys difficult. So where are we now with the case? Len Weinglass, attorney for Antonio Guerrero, stated in a press conference this August, after the 11th Circuit decision, that this is not the end of the case, and there is a long way to go. And indeed, there is. There are 9 additional legal issues that are still pending before the court, including prosecutorial misconduct during the course of arguments before the jury, insufficient evidence concerning the charges of conspiracy to commit espionage and murder, and erroneous application of procedures related to classified information and foreign intelligence surveillance. At this stage, the attorneys are still deciding whether to seek review by the U.S. Supreme Court or to return to the 3-judge panel on those remaining 9 issues. With major political cases such as this, it is essential that a strong people's movement declare its outrage and raise awareness of the case and its injustices. The U.S. media has never covered the case of the five, and we've just learned that this government has paid journalists in Miami to write stories critical of Cuba, stories that ran in the newspapers throughout the trial of the five, and that no doubt had a huge impact on public opinion and on the judges at that time. There have been countless other stories of the Bush administration buying favorable press. Those stories tarnish the democratic process in this country. And in this case, the timing of the paid-for journalism suggests something even more insidious. Influencing public opinion in Miami at the time of the Cuban Five trial amounts to jury tampering. We need to turn the tide of public opinion toward justice. Please consider writing op-ed pieces about this case or writing letters to your local newspapers so that more will learn about what really happened. Most don't even know in this country who the Cuban Five are. With as many colleagues and friends, since word of mouth is still the most effective means of communication. Together, we must free the Five. Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
of an existence. Misunderstand.
Enjoy playing for y'all. Y'all really been-